It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Coming up, Wisconsin's job numbers are out and unemployment is below 6% for the first time since fall of 2008.
First, why haven't conservatives been able to crack the code on political humor? Fox's efforts to create a conservative version of The Daily Show, with shows like Red Eye and Half Hour News Hour, never found mainstream success.
Now, a new conservative satire called Flipside, hosted by comedian Michael Loftus, will premiere in the fall. But can it take off? Joining us now to talk about the outlook for conservative comedy is Sean McElwee. He's a writer whose work has appeared in The Atlantic and Rolling Stone. Sean, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about Flipside?
Oh, I mean, the basic premise is to have something that's like The Daily Show, although it's not going to be on right now, they don't have broadcast syndication, so it's going to be on places like Netflix.
Oh, okay. So it's a over the top kind of thing. What do they call that?
I mean, over the internet, the basic premise is about the same thing. We have about 20 minutes of various bits or discussing the news, and then a short interview segment.
So this isn't real TV necessarily.
They're looking still for broadcast syndication, but it hasn't been picked up as of yet.
So why do you think that conservative TV comedy has trouble getting off the ground, or has had trouble getting off the ground in the past?
Well, yeah, the thing I don't think it is I don't think there's a structural philosophical problem with conservative comedy, as people have suggested. I think instead the main problem has just been institutional. So at Fox News, when you have the half-hour news hour, you also have the more conservative, not in the sense of political ideology, but in the older viewership. So a lot of the bits that they wanted to do, this isn't from an interview featured in a book, they didn't have the creative freedom to do because they wanted to make sure they didn't offend anyone in the audience. Now, there has been successful conservative comedy, and I would give as example Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn, mm-hmm. or South Park. But in both of those instances, you put the funny first ahead of the ideology, and there was a lot more creative freedom.
Now what some people would point to a fake conservative as being successful. Let's just listen to a little bit of this.
The people who work with the homeless say don't give them money. It's a bad thing. You're an enabler. You're enabling their alcohol or their drug habit.
Remember what Jesus said about giving things to people you don't know. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Suckers, this is a fake beard. I'm secretly rich. My dad's God. Burn!
So that was Stephen Colbert, who has acted as if he's a conservative. Do you think that that's conservative humor, or do you think that's liberal humor?
Oh, I mean, it's rather clearly liberal humor.
Yeah.
He's mocking the hypocrisy of someone like, say, Bill O'Reilly. And there is hypocrisy to be mocked. I also think that there might be hypocrisy on the liberal side that could be mocked as well. And places like Tough Crowd and South Park and even sometimes Red Eye have managed to point those hypocrisies out.
And do you think that that's something that could happen as Stephen Colbert sheds his fake personality and becomes a real person as well?
Do I think that the Comedy Central will replace Stephen Colbert with a more conservative? I don't think so, mainly because of the experience of Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn. The fact is that a really young audience that's going to watch Comedy Central isn't really too interested in seeing a conservative hosting a show there.
So do you think that Flipside has the potential to turn this around?
I think that there's definitely the material there. There's a possibility there. I think there's one of the executive producers I talked to said, you know, both John Boehner and Joe Biden are walking punchlines. There is room there, but they're going to have to put the ideology second. It's got to be funny, first of all. And I think one of the things that makes John Stewart so powerful is he is a liberal, but he's not afraid to call out liberal hypocrisy. He's not afraid to really mock liberals. Granted, he mocks conservatives far more often, but he does seem to be above the fray. George Carlin was above the fray. Lenny Bruce was above the fray. I don't think you could say that Lenny Bruce was a Democrat in any way. He was more almost libertarian. Same with all the greats.
Now, I mean, you did some writing about this, an article about this, mm-hmm. this whole concept, and one of the things that I think you found was that there are some people who think that maybe this whole political conservative liberal thing is sort of running its course.
Mm-hmm. In what sense? Sorry.
I think Mark Maron may have said something to you about how he prefers to avoid going in either direction. I mean, do you think that it's possible that that with Stephen Colbert moving to the mainstream, you know, taking over for David Letterman on CBS, things like that, you think it's possible that maybe liberal and conservative humor will be going away from television and will be moving into a new era?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, Stephen Colbert, I'm sure, is going to be less. I don't know how political he's going to be, but I think there's always going to be room for political comedy. I mean, it wasn't Mark Maron's thing. He wanted to do a lot more personal comedy towards the as his career is more winding down. But I think there's a lot of young people who want to give political comedy a crack and haven't gotten that chance yet. So I think there's still going to be a flourishing.
So and you basically believe that there's still a lot. I mean, one question I'd have about this is maybe it's not on cable TV, but in some ways, couldn't you say that in some respects, Rush Limbaugh is kind of humorous in his own way?
Oh, yeah, exactly. The reason I wrote the piece was because I thought it was so absurd to read these academics suggesting that it's impossible to have conservative comedy when we empirically know that's not true. It exists already. Now, I do think that with the development of things like Netflix, you can hit an audience that maybe wasn't able to be hit before when you have to – I mean, with TV, you have to have such a broad audience because you need to sell things. But on Netflix, we've already seen a lot of shows that would never get on television but are able to actually sell really well. So I think in this case, there were issues before in terms of markets with a conservative show. I mean, Red Eye has to air at, you know, what, 3 a.m. So so I think now there can be a conservative show because these issues have gone out of the way.
Now there are some people who say that we're sort of in a golden age of television. It sounds like you're agreeing with that and saying that this does open up the potential for more variety and more diversity in the kind of views you see in TV.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
All right. Well, Sean, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sean McElwee is a writer whose work has been featured in The Atlantic, Salon, The New Republic, and Rolling Stone. He blogs at seanmcelwee.com.
Unemployment in Wisconsin has dipped below 6% for the first time since November 2008, which was the beginning of the financial crisis.
Now, that's down from a height of 9.2% in 2010. Now, Wisconsin gained 6,400 private sector jobs in March, but are these jobs in the same caliber of jobs lost half a decade ago? And are people still giving up on finding unemployment and dropping out of the workforce?
Here with us to help make sense of the numbers is Associate Professor of Business Administration at Wisconsin Lutheran College, Brian Jacobson. Brian, thanks for being here.
No, well, thank you so much for having me.
So where does 5.9% unemployment stand in the range of what's healthy for an economy?
Well, you know, believe it or not, it's still slightly high relative to where we would like it to be in the long run. Now, Wisconsin historically has had an unemployment rate that has been less than the national average. And so having Wisconsin at 5.9% right now and the nation at 6.7%, that's a pretty big gap. But what we would like to see over the long term is probably something closer to around 5.5%. So there's still some room for improvement here.
This probably has a complex answer. It's going to seem like a very elementary question, though. Why has unemployment fallen to 5.9%? What factors are at play here?
That is not a bad question at all. It's actually a great question because there are a couple things that can happen to drive down the unemployment rate. One is obviously fewer unemployed people. So that's a good reason for the unemployment rate to fall. Now, in order to understand that there can be a bad reason for the unemployment rate to fall, you have to understand exactly how it's calculated. It's based on the percentage of the labor force that is unemployed. So the labor force is not the entire population. It's basically those people who are employed, or if you're unemployed, that you are looking for work or have been looking for work over the last 4 weeks. So you can have the labor force shrinking, which could then drive down the unemployment rate. So it can give a false message, and that, in fact, is one of the reasons why sort of early on in the economic recovery, we saw the unemployment rate actually improve is whenever the labor force would shrink. But that was a bad reason. In general, for the state of Wisconsin, if you were to look at a chart going all the way back to, oh, maybe 2010, the trend for employment has been improving, but the labor force hasn't really moved all that much. We actually had somewhat of a shrinkage of the labor force.
Well, that actually brings up a point. According to reports out at the end of March, Wisconsin lost the second most jobs of any state in the country in February. That was at about 9,500 jobs. So it does seem contradictory to the relatively good news that we're talking about here.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. So when people are unemployed, they might just give up looking, which means that they would probably drop out of the labor force, and then they're just not included in the statistics. So that's one of the reasons why the chair of the Federal Reserve Board has encouraged people to stop focusing so much on the unemployment rate as a measure of health of the labor market and look at a wider spectrum of measures, things like the duration of unemployed, the number of people who are long-term unemployed, and in the government statistics, long-term means 27 weeks or longer. And for the nation as a whole, those numbers aren't really improving all that much. Now, unfortunately, those numbers aren't really all that readily available on a state-level basis, so I can't really speak to what's going on in Wisconsin for some of those other measures. But for the nation as a whole, there's still a lot of healing that needs to take place.
Mm-hmm. How long will it take to achieve that?
According to my forecasts, I think that we could be, according to recent trends, probably it could take anywhere from 2 to 3 years, which is going to seem like an interminably long time for a lot of people, especially if they're the ones who are looking for work. But in order to sort of, I know that some politicians have come out and said that, you know, they are promising to heal the economy and make dramatic changes. Keep in mind, some of these dramatic changes that can be made, it won't necessarily immediately be reflected in the labor force statistics or in the economy, because the economy is such a big thing and politicians can only influence things so much.
And when you say that the economy might be healed in 2 or 3 years, what does that look like and what would the numbers show?
Well, I think that for the nation as a whole, we would be looking at having inflation running at around 2%. We would be looking at having the unemployment rate close to 5.5%, maybe a little bit lower than that. We'd probably also see things like weekly average earnings increasing. That's been one of the things that's really been weighing on me, is the idea that even though we are seeing more jobs being created, we haven't exactly seen average weekly earnings increasing, or if they are increasing, it's barely keeping pace with inflation. The Bureau of Labor Statistics just released some numbers as far as for the nation as a whole, that the median worker out there only made about $796 per week in the last quarter, and that was up 3% from a year ago, but inflation was about up 1.5%. So really, when you sort of adjust for inflation, the real purchasing power of a person's income on average only went up about 1.5%. So when we actually get to a healthier state for the economy, I'd like to see that number increasing closer to about 3%.
Well, as job growth goes, what kind of industries are these jobs being created in, that the ones that we are seeing some increase in?
You know, we can take a look at as far as where we were about a year ago. And a lot of the jobs, believe it or not, despite all the problems with the losses in the construction industry, that's making a comeback. So construction, compared to a year ago, those jobs were about 7% higher as far as the number of people employed there. Construction jobs are typically better paying jobs, so that's nice to see. However, we also see an increase in the number of people, at least in the state of Wisconsin, that are employed in the leisure and hospitality area. That number is up about 1.5%. Now, for the nation as a whole, unfortunately, those are typically some of the lower-paying jobs. On average, the people in those industries make about $357 to $358 per week. So that's actually less than half of what the average is for the private sector. Mm-hmm. So we've seen an improvement in construction, leisure, and hospitality, but we've also seen an improvement in the professional and business services. Now, that's kind of a mixed bag as far as the types of jobs, because some of them can be very good-paying, management-type positions. But within that category, you also get temporary help jobs. So that one is a little bit mixed as far as whether or not it's good or bad to see improvements there.
And how is manufacturing doing?
Manufacturing has been faring fairly well in Wisconsin as far as output. However, if you look at compared to a year ago, so if we go back to the most reliable numbers that we have, which is for the quarterly census on employment and wages, those come out with quite a lag. So going back to September, manufacturing employment actually shrank by about 0.2%. So, you know, it's kind of a rounding error. So there aren't a lot of jobs being created there on net, but we are seeing an improvement if you break up manufacturing into durable goods, which are making things that are expected to last about 3 years or longer, things like washers, dryers, cars, and non-durables, things that are not expected to last a while. We've seen a significant improvement in the durable goods manufacturing, and really Wisconsin is known as being a kind of manufacturing heavy economy, and so it's nice to see the durable goods manufacturing employment begin to make a comeback.
Well, and you mentioned the jobs in leisure and hospitality not only garnering lower wages, but it doesn't seem like a very stable industry. Many of those hospitality jobs here in Wisconsin, in fact, are seasonal when you think about maybe the Dells area and other summer vacation spots.
Yes, and that is absolutely correct, that a lot of the leisure and hospitality jobs, those tend to be higher turnover, meaning that you do get that churn of the workforce, but it also tends to be a very good stepping stone to other types of occupations, or it's a good way to get at least some work experience. So you're absolutely right that those don't necessarily tend to be the types of jobs that people necessarily stick with, but that's also why they tend to be some of the lower-paying ones. They're very much entry-level, at least as far as what we typically see, the bulk of employees in that specific industry.
And what does it take to bring increased wages to employees? You mentioned that that's going to be an important factor here, especially for the people who are looking for jobs. Why aren't we seeing an increase of wages right now?
Yeah, you know, that is one of the puzzles out there as far as what could drive wages higher. And really, a big part of it is just a matter of having a overall stronger economy as far as with some of the, like with global trade, if we are able to see a dramatic increase in purchases of goods and services overseas that we can export to. So if you see more dramatic growth there, if we see consumer spending begin to pick up. In some of the most recent data that came out of the federal government as far as with retail sales for last month, we do see people kind of coming out of hibernation, so to speak, from the cold winter weather, at least as far as spending on the retail side. So that's a positive sign. But I think that in terms of in order to actually see wages begin to increase, part of it is to have just businesses continue to be profitable and be more begin to anticipate that that demand that they're seeing is actually sustainable. I still think there's a lot of skepticism amongst a lot of business owners as to whether or not the growth that they're seeing is indeed going to be sustainable.
Yeah, or yeah, and last a while and all that. So it makes it harder to decide perhaps how to allocate those funds. Do we know how statistics have shaped up in terms of how many Wisconsinites are still living in poverty alongside these job numbers?
Well, with these job numbers, I'm not sure if that actually was updated or not as to the number of people who are living in poverty. I mean, it is obviously a big concern as far as the percentage of people in poverty, the number of people who are receiving government assistance in the form of, say, food stamps. For the nation as a whole, the number of people on food stamps has begun to decline, which is certainly something to be encouraged about. One thing that I'd want to point out, though, as far as when you're looking at some of those numbers, it tends to be very geographic. geographically concentrated. So even if we're talking about, say, on average, you know, 14% to the 15% of the population is living in poverty, they tend to be clustered. And so this tends to be a kind of more of a community issue as well, as far as you will tend to see poverty rates, say, in Milwaukee being much higher than poverty rates in Dane County. So some of the details are obscured by just looking at the averages.
Okay. And we'll dig into that a little bit after the break. We're speaking with Brian Jacobson, Associate Professor of Business Administration at Wisconsin Lutheran College. Job numbers are out today in Wisconsin for the month of March. And for the first time since November 2008, unemployment is below 6%.
And we'd like to hear from you. How are things going economically from your perspective? Have you been unemployed in the past decade? Or what was your experience in finding a new job? Are the jobs available as good as the jobs that were available before the financial crisis? And do you think this is a significant turnaround for Wisconsin, or are things moving slowly? Why don't you call in and join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back with Brian Jacobson, Associate Professor of Business Administration at Wisconsin Lutheran College. He's here with us talking about Wisconsin's labor economy. Unemployment in the state is below 6% for the first time since November 2008.
And we'd like to hear from you. Have you been unemployed for the last few years? What was the experience like of trying to find a new job? Are the jobs available as good as the jobs that were available before the financial crisis? What do you think? Is this a significant turnaround, these new numbers that we're hearing about? You can give us a call and let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Brian Jacobson, let's just take a step back for just a moment. And could you explain for us what drives job growth generally?
Well, job growth is typically created by businesses that, as they want to expand, they're going to have to hire somebody, right? And so if you think about as far as what's sort of the origin of a job, it really comes from an employer, somebody who is willing to hire somebody to take that risk in order to produce something, a good or a service for somebody else. So, you know, it really does require some entrepreneurship, or it requires an existing business that wants to expand. So they have to have some idea that there's something profitable for them out there. And that's one of the things that I think Wisconsin has tended to struggle with, is not necessarily with existing businesses about how to help them grow, but it's more about having those new businesses, creating these new opportunities, because we've tended to lag in terms of number of new businesses being created.
Mm. Let's take a call from Richie in La Crosse. Richie, what's your question?
My question is, how do you measure unemployment? I know nationally there are 2.4 million people in prison, 7.4 million people monitored by the state, 12 million people that are ex-cons, 65 million people that can't pass the background check. From anybody else's measurement, that's 23% unemployment. How do you measure unemployment in the state of Wisconsin? Mm-hmm.
Oh, great question. And this does get into some of the weeds about some of this data, and maybe points to the limitations of the data, because typically the definition is that they have to be, they can't be institutionalized. And so institutionalized means that if they're in prison, they're just not counted as being part of the labor force or being employed or unemployed. So a lot of those examples that you just gave there, though we would view them as not working, they would be actually institutionalized or outside of the labor force, and they would not be counted as unemployed.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned before the break that these statistics are highly geographic in their nature, and that sometimes the average amounts that we see are misleading. Let's dig into that a little bit. Are you familiar, for example, with some of the regional numbers that stack up here in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, some of these numbers, they're really difficult to come by from the federal government's statistics, because they come out with such a lag, and they were really designed to measure national employment, not regional employment. Mm-hmm. Some of the more reliable things that I've seen is that if you look at some of the maps as far as the unemployment rate, say, in Wisconsin, you can actually see how it is that areas like Dane County, Waukesha County, they have even out of Gamey County, County have fared pretty well just with this most recent data release as far as the number of jobs that were being created. Where didn't they fare quite as well? Well, the Milwaukee County, they didn't fare quite as well. And then a lot of the areas, especially if you get into some of north of Green Bay, a lot of those counties didn't necessarily do quite as well. So there is a lot of geographical diversity. You can have one area, Dane County and Waukesha County, doing very well, but you can have other counties that have very high levels of unemployment yet.
And are these differences specific to those areas? Is it, in a sense, impossible for Milwaukee County to look at Waukesha County and mimic what they're doing with their economy or not?
That's always the thing that when it comes to some of the city politics or county politics, as far as, you know, policies that are in place in one area, do they necessarily work or translate into another? And I think that's where you have to kind of step back and look at the basic principles as far as how is it that you can create an environment that's more conducive to economic growth. Each area is probably going to have a different approach to that. If you have, let's say, Milwaukee, which is has a much higher population density, you're going to have different solutions for that area than you would say for if we go up to Oneida County. And just to give you an idea, if we're looking at Oneida, their unemployment rate is about 10.2%, whereas in Milwaukee, it's closer to 7.9%. So because of population density and some of the natural features, as far as what are the typical employers there, what's your existing base upon which you can build? Obviously, Milwaukee has a little bit more diverse population, not only in terms of demographics, but also diverse in terms of employment opportunities. You have very large manufacturers. You have also some of the service providers, where in some counties they might rely a little bit more upon, like, let's say, natural resources and mining. So they're going to have very different approaches to how to deal with some of these issues.
Let's take another call from Jim and Rhinelander. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Two comments. First one, I don't know if you mentioned it or not, but did the fact that probably a lot of people are no longer collecting unemployment, or they can't, does that, do you take that in consideration when you figure out unemployment? And the second one, I really like to make this point, and the fact is that businesses don't create jobs on their own. It's really consumers that create jobs. So, I think we need to stress that more, that a business doesn't create a job if there aren't consumers, wanting to buy a product. And what I'm getting at is when people aren't working or are making a living wage, you're not going to be doing hiring, or, the economy's not going to be doing well.
Okay. Brian Jacobson.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It takes both. It takes two to tango. It takes a consumer and it also takes a business. So you absolutely need that interaction. So, that's a very valid point, and we shouldn't denigrate either side of that equation, the fact that it takes an employer to have an employee, but it also takes a consumer to create the demand for the product. You have to look at both. The unemployment insurance benefits. In order to collect unemployment insurance, you do have to be looking for a job, and so those people would be considered unemployed. But there are other people besides those who collect unemployment insurance who would also be counted as unemployed. For those individuals who lose their benefits, maybe they've exhausted the benefits. It all depends upon what do they do. Do they continue to look for a job, or do they give up? If they give up looking for a job, even though, not much has changed, they are no longer counted as unemployed. They are outside of the labor force. And again, that highlights, I think, one of the shortcomings of looking at the unemployment rate as one of those statistics, because it does depend upon the individual looking for a job within the last 4 weeks. There are alternative measures of unemployment. There's actually a huge menu of them. You can look at what some people refer to as the U6 unemployment rate. It's just a broader definition which includes those people perhaps who were collecting unemployment insurance and stopped looking for work after they exhausted their benefits. And for that measure of unemployment, that is significantly higher because it's including more people. It's expanding that net as far as who it is that's included as being unemployed or not. And that is still elevated relative to historical standards.
Well, you've outlined some of the pitfalls here in the relying on the statistics and measurements for unemployment numbers. Nevertheless, that number is often tossed about in political races, and it certainly was a deciding factor in recent elections. Do you think the economy is going to be a deciding factor in this fall's gubernatorial election?
Typically, the economy is a deciding factor. For a lot of times when economists and political scientists look at forecasting elections, economic variables always enter in as far as a key determinant. So I think that the economy is definitely going to play an important role. And so usually what happens is if you see an improving unemployment rate, that is the unemployment rate dropping, that tends to be very good for whoever the incumbent is or the incumbent party. So in this case, if we continue to see improvements in the unemployment rate, that would probably bode fairly well for Governor Walker. If Governor Walker wasn't running for re-election, it would bode pretty well for the Republican Party because, rational or not, individual voters tend to associate an improving economy. They tend to give credit for that to whoever the incumbent is. But at the same time, a worsening economy, they tend to blame the incumbent. So, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Mm. Well, Brian, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We've been speaking with Brian Jacobson. He's Associate Professor of Business Administration at Wisconsin Lutheran College. Job numbers out today say that the unemployment rate in Wisconsin is 5.9%, the first time below 6% since November 2008.
We'll get a taste of some of the newest releases in the world of folk music with WPR's resident expert. Actually, not just folk. We'll also talk about classical music with Stephanie Elkins.
She's host of WPR Simply Folk and Morning Classics, and she's with us to share some new songs. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Well, we hear one of these selections right now behind us. Tell us about it.
This is the Punch Brothers. We just got it into our collection just a few weeks ago. It's been out for a little while, though. And it's a recording that is filled with energy, and it has them getting back to their roots a little bit. This is Chris Thiele, the mandolin player. He won the MacArthur Genius Grant about a year and a half ago. And we played some of his music on our classical side. He's one of those crossover musicians. Mm. But together, this is just filled with energy and very powerful music. Love it.
Let's take a listen to just a few more seconds. You mentioned the Chris Thiele. Am I saying his name right?
Thiele.
Thiele.
Yeah.
As a crossover musician, do you know, have you spoken to anybody who's done that? How difficult is it to change the style? You know, you're playing the same instrument, but different genres.
It is, and there are quite a few musicians who do it, and we're seeing it more and more with people like Yo-Yo Ma and... Mm. There are quite a few. Susan Werner comes to mind, who does jazz, and she does folk, and there are quite a few in the library sometimes that we don't know how to categorize, and we're getting more and more in like that.
How do you decide? Do you have a judging panel?
We do have some people in the building that listen for us and help us figure out what the genre is going to be. But no, we just sort of try and be as more inclusive than exclusive. So if it's folk rock, folk jazz, folk country, we try and be accommodating.
Nice. It's hard to apply science to an art, isn't it?
It is. Very subjective, very subjective.
Who else have you brought in?
Well, we're going to hear Carrie Newcomer. She has a brand new CD, literally just came in the mail this past week. She has one of these rich alto voices, and she gets recording quality. I don't know how she does it, but the sound is just amazing. She's a real sort of philosophical writer, and her lyrics marry really well with her melodies, and the production also supports the music. It's just great.
Let's take a listen.
Please recount with a rasping sound a shadow cast on the autumn ground. It's a lovely wish, it's a tender sight, a promise made on shifting light. Bad news from the start, and still that gave my heart. There's a hole in the world, I've seen it.
The name of the song is called The 10 O'Clock Line, and that refers to a treaty made with the Native peoples of Indiana based on where the shadow falls at 10 o'clock in September. And that story stuck with her for years and became the topic of this particular song.
Wow. I hear a little bit of Roseanne Cash when I hear her voice. Is that a fair comparison?
I think so. She's got that kind of rich sound, that round sound, and a sense of... you really hear the spirit of herself through the music, if that makes any sense. And I hear that with Roseanne Cash. Mm. Love Roseanne Cash. Her list, the one of her dad's favorite songs, is one of my favorites.
Yes. And she has something new out, too.
She does.
Well, let's talk about Amy Ray. You've brought her in, too. What should we know about her?
Well, Amy Ray was here for an unplugged session with Simply Folk about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago. And she was just the warmest, most wonderful Southern person, intellectual and smart. And now she's done her first country album. And she has some really wonderful musicians participating with her, including Justin Vernon from the Eau Claire area and Kelly Hogan. Both of those are based in Wisconsin. And so it's really... She's really put together a group of great musicians, but she also recorded it in Asheville, North Carolina, and she did it with all analog recording equipment and no software, no quantizing, which is what makes it always perfectly on the beat, no auto-tuning. So this is a really natural CD. And we're going to hear a song about Duane Allman. That's the name of the song.
She came on up from way across the air, from a whiskey swamp and a vagabond clan, with a tune in her bucket and her head held high, and a book about her grandpa flying the skies. She said, man, it ain't never gonna be the same, you know, I'll give him a chance, but no one can play like you. Now it was back in the fall of 71. Dwayne met a flatbed coming home with a song in the charts and his Harley flying through the air. Now he was just in the stride when the angels wept. He said, man, it ain't never gonna be the same. And no one give him a chance. No one can play like Dwayne.
She discovered the Allman Brothers when she was a youngster, and when she was in seventh grade, she found out that he had died, and it really had a strong impact on her as a young budding musician. Mm. And she had been salting that away as the germ of a song for a long time, so this is how it came out. And she's singing here with Susan Tedeschi, the wonderful blues singer who's married to Derek Trucks, who's played with the Allman Brothers Band for a long time.
Oh, wow. So she even got to kind of meet her connection there to the Allman Brothers. That's nice. Well, we have a couple of more selections to go through. And then, of course, if there's time, I want to talk to you about how you select such wonderful music and what gets you excited about them. You brought in Robbie Hecht. Tell us about Robbie Hecht.
You know, our assistant news director, Noah Ofshinsky, is the one who shared this musician with me. He said, you've got to check him out, and I did. He has a voice that's been described as a warm blanket, and his songwriting is just superb. He was an English major and history major here at the UW, and he went from here to Nashville and started his music career, and his writing is just exquisite. He makes these intimate songs. You feel like you're right in the living room with him singing to you. And the one that we're going to hear an excerpt of is called Stars. And he wrote about this song that he's reaching an age in his life where almost everybody he knows has lost someone close. And this is a song for them. It's about that struggle that we go through mourning as we learn to let go.
What am I supposed to do in the dark? What am I supposed to do in the dark? What am I supposed to do in the dark?
Yeah, much different mood from the others.
It is. It's really kind of an introspective song, and his songs are deep. They're really wonderful. Most of them are kind of intimate like that. And what I like about this one, too, is it starts with a really spare guitar, and then he adds piano, and then the bass comes in. There's a Lowry organ, so it just sort of builds very slowly the way, you know, I just responded to it emotionally. It's just one of those kinds of songs. And he said that he's going to try and set up something in Wisconsin, and if he comes through the state, he'll come say hi to us.
So that's great.
Really good, and play a little
more,
bit of music.
More reason to tune into Simply Folk. But Stephanie, you don't just host Simply Folk. You are also a classical host on Wisconsin Public Radio. And so, of course, we have to tip our hats a bit to the classical genre. What have you brought for us?
We've got some really high-energy classical music. This is Baroque music written by Vivaldi back around 1725 or so.
I'm going to pause you.
Okay.
Many people would say high-energy classical music.
There is such a thing, and that's what attracted me about this recording. It just came in, and the violinist and the ensemble, they're young and energetic, and they just play the heck out of Vivaldi. Vivaldi was a music director at an orphanage for girls, and he was so good that it became like parents were trying to get their kids in, even if they weren't orphans, because of the music program. And he had some extremely talented musicians, which is you'll see when you hear the playing and think what these girls were doing. But this particular one is for two violins and strings, and this is a violinist that I stumbled across on YouTube, literally. He's amazing. He's Italian. His name is Riccardo Manassi, and he's playing with a Russian named Dmitry Sinkovsky. So this is high energy, don't you think?
Yeah, I could say that. And I wanted to ask you, too, as we only have 30 seconds here. You're listening. You see a lot of music come across your desk. How do you choose what to feature here and what to bring to our homes?
200 to 300 song tracks a week come in, and it has to be in tune, and the lyrics have to match the music, and the production has to be really high quality. It's those ones, and they stand out. The cream of the crop just stand right out, so you hear it right away, and then you're intrigued and sucked in. You want to hear the next one, and it's an emotional response. You know, if I feel myself start to get teary over a song or a lyric, then that's why. That's how I choose.
Stephanie, thank you for sharing your expertise with us. We'll have you on again.
Thank you so much.
Stephanie Elkins hosts Simply Folk on Wisconsin Public Radio Sunday nights and classical music weekday mornings. I'm Cynthia Schuster with Mike Arnold. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.